But that doesn't make for nearly as good a copy as saying, oh, they're all a bunch of racists. But, guys, we've done it to another hour.
Right on.
Bro.
I stand in stark amazement at our ability to take 60 minutes out and just run it out behind the barn and massacre it. So, John, you've got a great show coming up. Peter, thank you very much for taking time to join us.
Hugs, guys.
And we'll talk to you soon, and John will be with you in a minute.
All right. Billy Shears coming up.
All righty. And in the meantime, here's the late, great Lowell George reminding you to...
This is a top to, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
and the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366. Or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
Hey, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Thursday night or Friday morning or Friday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful blue marble, such that it still is, and being that it's that Thursday-Friday night thing, and I tell you, usually it all kind of just runs together like one consistent continuum for me, but for some reason I've got a really bad case of like Friday-itis. probably because it's Friday here, and it's kind of beautiful, sunny autumn day out there, and yeah, it's nice. And it all kind of disappears at about 5 o'clock every day now. Days are getting, like, super short. Yeah, so that's that. And but we got a part two of the Stevie Winwood series from Mr. Billy Shears. And basically just going to clean house a little bit. Got some leftovers from yesterday, like most of yesterday's show, after an extended conversation with David from Maine. So we'll get through all that stuff that I didn't even get to touch on yesterday and a couple of other things before we get out of here for the weekend. Part two of... I have no idea how many parts there are. This could be... Bob says, oh yeah, that'll do. I'll call it Beer 30. You know, it's just... You get that vibe once in a while. It's just like, you know, it's one of those days, you know, could just throw it all away and go, like, walk off down the beach, you know. And just But I have, I don't know if I missed it. I don't know how many parts there are going to be to the Steve Winwood thing. So this could be, like, part two of two or part two of three or part two of 25, which I kind of doubt. Of Billy Shears, and don't forget, every Saturday night, 9 to midnight here on the Head On Radio Network, Night Sounds with Mr. Billy Shears. You can check him out at billyshearsmusic.com. So, without further ado, Billy Shears on Mr. Steve Winwood, Part 2. Roll it, Bob.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hi, this is Steve Winwood. Welcome back to a behind-the-scenes look at my new album, Nine Lives.
Steve Winwood was born in Birmingham, England. He first started performing with his father and his older brother, Muff Winwood, at the age of 8. When he was 15, he and his brother hooked up with school teacher and moonlighting guitarist, Spencer Davis.
I was looking for musicians, and somebody said, go and see this band called the Muff Woody Jazz Band. They're playing in a pub in Erdington. Erdington is a northern suburb of Birmingham. I went and saw the band playing, and there's this one guy. I mean, it was Steve, obviously. And he played a melodica. It's not a sort of instrument you blow, but it's a keyboard instrument. And he was playing One Mint Julep, you know, Ray Charles thing. And I was like, ooh, that thing would sound great in the band. He didn't actually sing when I saw him. But then he got down and played piano, and he played piano like Oscar Peterson. And he was 15. So I thought, well, this is interesting. I mean, this will be one for the books. So I asked him if he would be interested in doing a gig with me at the Golden Eagle. Not necessarily joining a band, but would you do a gig? And he said, I'd love to. He says, but unfortunately, he says, well, I'm 15, I don't have a driving license. How am I going to get there? I said, well, I will come and get you.
Some Lovin' from the Spencer Davis Group, featuring the soulful voice and organ of 17-year-old Steve Winwood. By 1967, Steve's longing for musical adventure pulled him away from Spencer Davis and into a union with Dave Mason, Jim Capaldi, and Chris Wood. It was the idyllic hippie lifestyle that led to a wildly creative band, Traffic.
We all decided that's what we wanted to do. Yeah, and all lived together, but I mean, of course we ended up living together in the most amazing squalor. And, you know, we lived on cheese sandwiches, rice pudding. that light to cook and light to clean up, that's right. And like food would be growing everywhere. It was terrible, really. So we'd have to recruit unsuspecting women. Now, Dave Mason actually used to like to cook. Just like maybe one day said, I know, I'm going to cook everybody something, whatever it was. So he'd go and cook. But, I mean, I don't think he's particularly great at tidying up afterwards, you know, in the great tradition of all chefs.
I bought a sequin suit from a pearly queen. She could drink more wine than I'd ever seen. She had some gypsy's blood going through her feet. And when the time was right, she said that I would meet my destiny. I traveled around the world to find her son. I couldn't stop myself from having.
In January of 2005, Steve lost his longtime songwriting partner and dear friend, Jim Capaldi. 2 years later, a celebration of Jim's life in music was held at the Roundhouse in London. Musical guests came and played Jim's songs, and they included Cat Stevens, Paul Weller, Pete Townsend, Jim's brother Phil, and of course, Steve Winwood.
It was amazing, and so many great people played at it. And what I found, obviously, it was a great tribute to Jim, and of course, Jim and I were very close and had worked together. But what intrigued me was the way those people, Joe Walsh, Pete Townsend, Paul Weller, and many others, the way they performed these songs, and many of the songs they performed were songs that I'd written with Jim. And let's face it, you know, Traffic didn't really write mainstream songs, and they weren't really particularly that coverable.
Yeah.
I think it was a great tribute to Jim. And also, Jim and I had an agreement that we would never tour as Traffic without each other. So, therefore, if you see Traffic advertised, don't go and see it.
Yeah, okay.
Because it probably have nothing to do with Traffic.
Steve's going to be opening shows for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers starting May 30th in Grand Rapids, and the tour winds up in Woodlands, Texas, August 29th. He's got himself an excellent band, and he's looking forward to playing new and old songs live.
It's Richard Bailey on drums, Carl van den Bosch percussion, Joe Zanetto, of course, on guitar, and Paul Booth on horns and back vocals and keyboards. He has a particular style of his music which is not absolutely joined at the hip with my kind of background of music, but, you know, having said that, I think that it is a common language, and I hope that I'll be able to bring something perhaps a little different to Tom's audience than the music that he's playing. The only thing, of course, is that some of these, as you call them, the ice hockey arenas, have a curfew, so as opposed to me doing my normal 2.5-3 hour show, it'll be much less. It'd probably be something between an hour and 75 minutes, which will actually give us the opportunity to change the show up a lot. And I mean, we're going to be aiming for something like not to repeat the song in the same week.
When waves cross on my sleeping pillow, I'm dreaming love would surely follow. See, we've been shadows on my balcony. There's nothing more than I can see. Thank you.
from Steve Winwood's new album, Nine Lives. That's We're All Looking. Join us next week for part three of Steve Winwood's Nine Lives. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Well, thanks, Billy. Okay, being that it's got this Nine Lives thing, does that mean it's going to be nine parts? Wow. But that, hey, Steve Winwood's a guy that you could do nine parts on. And that's my favorite era, personally, is that Traffic stuff. And I would have loved to have been there when Paul Weller would have played kind of in Traffic. That would have been cool. That would have been very cool. But there's something about the Traffic era stuff, and I don't know if it was the... His vocals just sat so nice on top of that slightly more guitar-driven, you know, blues slash, I don't know, there's some R&B about his vocal. I'm not quite sure what it is, but anyway, he's good. I totally dig. I kind of didn't dig some of the solo stuff a little later on. I just didn't think it was playing-wise up to par for him, but, you know, not everyone can shoot for the stars all the time. And it's what he wanted to do. He seemed to do all right without me. Now, but thanks for that, Billy. Looking forward to the next installment. I like these series ones. They're kind of fun. And before I forget, not just Billy on Saturday, but we have the return of Rick's Place with Mr. Rick Goodner at 7 p.m., 7 to 9 p.m., and that's very cool that he's coming back. And then we got this guy, new guy, Rick Smith, the Rick Smith Show from Pennsylvania, and he starts at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, if I'm not mistaken. I have to check him out. So back up to more cylinders on Saturday night, which is a good thing. But I've spoken in the past about how one of the things that seems to become more and more apparent, you know, even to just the shall we say active just someone who tries to keep up on this with the climate science and how it progresses, is this idea that climate change very much is affected by a feedback loop. And, you know, this is why every time we have a model done about, you know, temperature rises and everything else, and then 2 years later the next set of models come out, and not only were the previous models correct, but they always fell short, and it had seemed to accelerate. And we've seen this time and time again. Well, it's come up again. I think Betsy sent me this. If not, it was Jean, but I think it was Betsy. From Tree Hugger. A post just, are we moving into another era of abrupt climate change? Will the next large-scale manifestation of global warming prove to be just another blip in time? Or, as Mike Tidwell put in a recent Orion piece, a violent snap signaling a fundamental shift in our planet's climate. The idea, also advanced by noted environmental writer Fred Pierce in his latest book, has everything to do with what scientists call abrupt climate change. The U.S. Climate Change Science Program, which is currently seeking public comments for the revision of its synthesis and assessment report, defines abrupt climate change as a large-scale change in the climate system that takes place over a few decades or less, persists, or is anticipated to persist, for at least a few decades, and causes substantial disruptions in human and natural systems. The notion of abrupt climate change has been in the news again of late, with scientists and writers connecting the dots to point out that the crucial tipping point, or snap, may be not far off in the making. As Tidwell notes in his piece, decrying talk of climate snaps and tipping points as alarmist rhetoric is no longer a valid proposition, especially in light of the past year's events. He says, a climate snap? Really? It sounds so much like the standard fear-mongering and echo hyperbole, but here's proof. One of the most prestigious scientific bodies in the world, the group that just shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore for its climate work, predicted 14 months ago that unchecked global warming would erase all of the Arctic Ocean's summertime ice as early as 2070. Then just 2 months later, in April 2007, a separate scientific panel released data indicating that the 2070 mark was way off, suggesting that ice-free conditions could come to the Arctic as early as the summer of 2030. And if this acceleration weren't enough, yet another prediction emerged in December 2007, following the year's appalling melt season, in which vast stretches of Arctic ice the size of Florida vanished almost weekly at times. A credible new estimate from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, indicates there could be zero summer ice in the Arctic as early as 2013. So, you know, again, it keeps... This is why, you know, this is just so unbelievably urgent. Because the sooner we act, the sooner we're going to be able to actually pull some of this back. It just continues to just spin out of control. With the fact that we so far have effectively done very little. But it continues on saying, and here's what the Climate Science Program's report had to say on the issue. This report considers progress in understanding four types of abrupt climate change in the paleoclimactic record that stands out as being so rapid and large in their impact that if they were to reoccur, they pose clear risks to society in terms of our ability to, one, rapid change in glaciers, ice sheets, and hence sea level, two, widespread and sustained changes in the hydraulic cycle, three, abrupt change in the northward flow of warm, salty water in the upper layers of the Atlantic Ocean associated with the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, and four, rapid release of the atmosphere of methane trapped in the permafrost and on continental margins. Now, this whole thing about the fresh salty water thing is part of the, and you know, we've talked about this at length in the past on this program, and I know Bob's talked about it before, that, you know, these huge currents that, you know, move all this water from the UK down to the down past the south of Africa, you know, these things keep areas like the UK from ending up being, you know, ice locked in winter because they keep this water moving. And this thing keeps slowing as carbon saturation levels rise, which ends up causing ocean temperatures to rise. And this whole reaction is slowed down. It's even stalled a couple times. And it's thought, and, you know, this is one of those consensus of opinion things, that when that thing stops, if the temperature rise gets to be enough and that stalls, that kicks in the ice age. And it can happen over the matter of just a handful of years. That was the big revelation a couple of years ago. That the kick, once you kick the switch, it wasn't decades before you were in the ice age. It was a matter of 5 years, maybe even less. So, huh? So Tree Hugger continues. So what does this report tell us about the about abrupt climate change? For one thing, through the warming signs that are starting to appear, the authors, Peter Clark from the Oregon State University and Andrew Weaver from the University of Victoria, remain conservative in their projections, particularly with respect to predictions of future abrupt events. The report provides a fascinating insight into the current state of climate science and makes some fairly pessimistic predictions about potential long-term trends in weather patterns and climactic phenomena. The slowing down of the ocean conveyor belt by about 20 to 30% by century's end and a rapid rise in permafrost methane emissions pose some significant threats with possible large-scale ramifications for the global climate. The report's executive summary, which makes for an interesting, if disturbing at times, read, can be seen here. Click link. You can see this on yesterday's show post if you want to check this stuff out. While it's still too early to say what climate snaps in the future holds, and for that matter, if when those currently projected will take place, we certainly can't just let the existing warming signs, Arctic melting, surging methane emissions, etc., pass us by without action. Whether that means geoengineering, as Tidwell advocates, or pushing for drastic emissions cuts called, along the lines of Bill McKibben's 350.org effort, there is much room for improvement. We've actually, you know, more and more, it's becoming, you know, plainly obvious that we have passed the point of no return when it comes to actually being able to stop climate change completely. We're already seeing the effects. But we still have a chance to actually limit its effects, because the whole point of the exercise is there's a point where this place is going to get that where it can't support human life. It's not going to be in my generation. It's not going to be in our kids' generation. But, you know, a couple down, it could seriously be. Now, you know, I keep thinking of that. I read the other day from the transcripts of that interview with the Peak Oil guy on Late Line. And I keep thinking about him saying, unless suddenly all the governments of the world, you know, wake up one morning and go, we got to do it different. We got to get off this oil thing. We're kind of screwed. And that's not going to stop me coming up here every day and, you know, trying to hammer the point home, because I keep hoping that maybe tomorrow will be that day. I got to say, I'm a little disappointed in the budget down here. I think putting equal money into non-existent carbon sequestration projects and all other renewables was a bit wrong. But I will give them one more budget to try and start getting it right. I know they had a lot to deal with. But, you know, we haven't talked all that much on the network about these really bad natural disasters that have happened recently. And, you know, there's, was it Myanmar? They still call it Burma down here. And the earthquake in China. And I don't know if you all have heard this, and I don't think I got to this the other day, but you know that there's been a whole lot of trouble with down in Burma, where, you know, the United States, Australia, other nations send supplies, and they sent actual physical bodies to go and help try and rescue people, medical people, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that illegitimate government down there says, we'll take your stuff, but none of your people. And now it's being reported that Australian goods being sent over there are being relabeled as property of the Burmese government. So it makes one wonder. It's gotta make you wonder. What are they hiding over there? Gail's been talking about this a couple times over the last few days. You know, I don't know if this is getting any press in the United States. They're trying over here in Australia. We've got a couple of reporters that are early on were breaking the rules and broadcasting and there's talk about that, you know, they fear if they do get in, they're going to find, you know, the mountains of skulls at some in some hillside. And I've heard rumors of the Chinese doing the same kind of thing. They need equipment. They've asked for equipment. They'll take, you know, the food and the water and the supplies, but none of the physical help. And, it gets me thinking, I'm thinking, what makes these two nations turn down physical help in, in absolute crisis, beyond, crisis that's beyond any single nation to be able to deal with, no matter how well prepared. Because it's just chaos. And then my little wandering brain finds its way back to the not-so-distant past. I think about Katrina. I go, well, it's not just other people that turn away perfectly good help when you could use it. So what makes Burma, China, or the United States turn away volunteer help in the time of a tragedy? I would think most of the time you're trying to hide something. And the former treasurer from the previous government, his brother is like, this is seriously the situation of the evil and the good brother. The evil brother was the former treasurer in the Liberal Party under Howard. Completely just hateful prick. You know, he's just one of those people that, like, even his supporters say, but he's such an asshole. He's just, he did everything possible not to like him. Well, his brother, Tim Costello, works for World Vision. One of the only groups that's been allowed to function in there. And it seems to be, from an interview that I heard with him, it seems to be because his operations with 600 staff in Burma are all staffed by Burmese. There's only skeleton Australian crew there, I guess. So they're allowed to work. So, again, and he's always very reserved. So, I gotta wonder, if we weren't so tied up in flights of fancy like Iraq, we might be actually looking over there and going, we're offering help. Why aren't you taking it? And maybe, there are probably much better causes to be putting energy into. But it's not looking good in either of those situations, just tens of thousands dead. And, in China, that bloody school, one school, 900 students buried. It's just, that's beyond comprehension. And, there's all kinds of reports about the dams in China as well. They've been running around, military guys and whatnot, going and patching up all these brand new dams. And that's possibly going to be another problem. If they have, with all this growth that China's been going through, if they've done all the infrastructure on the cheap, they could be so screwed with something like this. What if a couple of these massive dams that they've built goes? A few towns swept away. an empire built on a, shoddy foundation can be a dangerous thing unto itself. Bob's asking the right question. What happens when the Three Gorges Dam goes? When it caves in? How many people will die? How much of that machine that is China will shut down? I've been thinking about this a bit over the last couple of days. China, is in the midst of this huge PR fiasco, which is the Olympics. They have been in overdrive with their economy growth for years now. And, at such an alarming rate that it's been, there was never anything that the world could throw at them that they couldn't accomplish. Well, has it all been done on the cheap? Has it all been done on the cheap? The whole reason why we can't pay a real wage to an American or an Australian to make that doohickey, we're going to buy it from way over there and ship it over here, because even with all the shipping, it's still cheaper to make it over there. So, part of my brain sits there and goes, watch this. And, that dam is huge. Huge. Could be very, 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 very scary. How about a couple more very, verys? I can see, if it's all built on the cheap, and it's like that Simpsons episode where with the dam made out of hollowed out concrete and the money being funneled off, if all this massive infrastructure has been built along those lines, there could be a real problem. We've already seen their train system, just absolutely pushed to the gills a few months ago. It's just been. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm trying to coyly get the next story up, and it wasn't working. Not very coy. But yeah, I've been just wondering about that, and this is a place that knows it's going to have earthquakes. So have they not engineered things in such a way? Gene sent this to me, and I'm actually just going to it without. It's the first time I'm having a look at it, and there's a YouTube video, but we won't worry about that. But there seems to be a bit of a transcription. This could be interesting. I think I just said it a few days ago, if we had actually listened to Jimmy Carter instead of maligning him and laughing him out of office, we could be in a very different situation today than we are currently in. And over at BSAlert.com, they have Jimmy Carter's televised speech on energy policy in America. Now, mind you, I haven't read this myself yet, but I bet this will be interesting. So this would have been April 18th, 1977. He says, "Tonight I want to have an unpleasant talk with you about a problem unprecedented in our history. With the exception of preventing war, this is the greatest challenge our country will face during our lifetimes. The energy crisis has not yet overwhelmed us, but it will if we do not act quickly. It is a problem we will not solve in the next few years, and it is likely to get progressively worse through the rest of this century. We must not be selfish or timid if we hope to have a decent world for our children and our grandchildren. We simply must balance our demand for energy and our rapid shrinking resources. By acting now, we can control our future instead of letting the future control us. 2 days from now, I will present my energy proposals to the Congress. Its members will be my partners, and they have already given me a great deal of valuable advice. Many of these proposals will be unpopular because some will cause you to put up with inconvenience and to make sacrifices. The most important thing about these proposals is that the alternatives may be a national catastrophe. Further delay can affect our strength and our power as a nation. Our decision about energy will test the character of the American people and the ability of the President and the Congress to govern. This difficult effort will be the moral equivalent of war, except that we will be uniting our efforts to build and not destroy. I know that some of you may doubt that we face real energy shortages. The 1973 gasoline lines are gone, our homes are warm again, but our energy problem is worse tonight than it was in 1973 or a few weeks ago in the dead of winter. It is worse because more waste has occurred and more time has passed by without our planning the future, and it will get worse every day until we act. Have you heard anything that hasn't been right yet? That hasn't, like, been proven absolutely spot on? The oil and natural gas we rely on for 75% of our energy is running out. This was 1977. In spite of increasing effort, domestic production has been dropping steadily at about 6% a year. Imports have doubled in the last 5 years. Our nation's independence of economic and political action is becoming increasingly constrained. Unless profound changes are made to lower oil consumption, we now believe that early in the 1980s, the world will be demanding more oil than it can produce. The world now uses about 60 million barrels of oil a day. What are we up to now? 100, 150-something? Each year, about 5%. This means that just to stay even, we need the production of a new Texas every year, an Alaskan North Slope every 9 months, or a new Saudi Arabia every 3 years. Obviously, this cannot continue. We must look back in history and understand our energy problems. Twice in the last several hundred years, there has been a transition in the way people use energy. For the first was about 200 years ago, away from wood, which had provided about 90% of all fuel, to coal, which was more efficient. This change came in the basis of the Industrial Revolution. The second change took place in this century. With the growing use of oil and natural gas, they were more convenient and cheaper than coal, and supply seemed to be almost without limit. They made possible the age of the automobile and airplane travel. Nearly everyone who is alive today grew up during this age, and we have never known anything different. I think that's an interesting... I think that's very crucial. We don't know any different. Hence how probably what makes the dependence even worse. Because we are now running out of gas and oil, we must prepare quickly for a third change to strict conservation and to the use of coal and permanent renewable energy sources like solar power. The world is not prepared for the future. During the 1950s, people used twice as much oil as during the 1940s. During the 1960s, we used twice as much as during the 1950s. And each of those decades, more oil was consumed than in all of mankind's previous history. Wow. World consumption of oil is still going up. If it were possible to keep it rising during the 1970s and 80s by 5% a year as it has in the past, we could use up all the proven reserves of oil in the entire world by the end of the next decade. That didn't come true, but they found some more reserves, but we're in the same situation. I know many of you have suspected that some supplies of oil and gas are being withheld. You may be right, but suspicions about oil companies cannot change the fact that we are running out of petroleum. All of us have heard about the large oil fields on the, Alaska's northern slope. In a few years, when the North Slope is producing fully, its total output will be just about equal to 2 years' increase in our national energy demand. Each new inventory of world oil reserves has been more disturbing than the last. World oil production has probably can probably keep going up for another 6 or 8 years, but sometime in the 1980s, it can't go up much more. Demand will overtake production. We have no choice about that. See, this is... that. I've been they did revise the peak oil product dates from this time, but I mean this was 77, and there have been new reserves found since. And one thing that I wonder how there's when it comes to the reserve estimates, that is something that makes it really hazy, makes it really, really difficult to know what to believe, is a few years ago, I can't remember exactly when, I remember reading this a while ago, there's no actual independent body that goes and verifies these estimates. The nations who own them get to supply their own estimates without check or approval or verification. And so, you know, you hear things like Saudi Arabia has revised their reserve estimates, you know, like I think 3 times in the last few years, and they've just gotten bigger and bigger. There's a lot of doubt about those figures because whatever you say your resources are, or your reserves are, affects the amount that, via the international agreements, that you're actually able to export. Now, so it would be in a country's interest to overblow those numbers to try and sell more oil faster, wouldn't it? So there's been accusations of that. So with no oversight on these estimates, can we actually believe that we have as much oil as they say we have, especially considering the fact that every single barrel of oil that we pull out of the ground is, you know, was harder to get out than the last? I don't think you have to be an environmentalist to want to get off of the petroleum addiction. I would think if you were a national security freak, you'd want to get off of oil and petroleum. I mean, Even though the peak oil numbers have been revised since this speech, the rest of it hasn't changed. Hemp fuel. Ah, Tim in the chat room. Hemp fuel. Oh, I'm big on that. I still, you know, I keep jumping up and down, and, you know, slowly it's being picked up on. You know, solar geothermal, thank you very much. It's just, you know, it's base load power. It's not going to deal with everything, but it can actually deal with baseload power generation. 100 square miles of Californian desert could actually power the entire U.S. grid just by the math. Now, you wouldn't just do it in one 100-mile block, but that's the math that's been done. All the coal-fired power plants could be shut down the next day if you could fire up 100 square miles of solar geothermal, and it's free. And after construction of the plant, it's carbon free. I think it's pretty good. So, you know, I mean, this kind of stuff needs to needs to be picked up on far more. And so I have this burning suspicion that the more scary estimates of peak oil are probably closer to what's true the sooner. Because I think we're going to find out that, you know, they lie to us about all this stuff and convince us to go to war over oil. What makes you think they're going to tell you the truth about anything else? What makes you think they're going to tell you the truth about how much they have in reserve? Because if they start saying that they actually have less in reserve, people will start to get more anxious about finding a replacement now, won't they? Thank you, Lilo. You're looking up the word there that I was not able to multitask to look up. Pop that in the chat room when you get that. Someone makes a statement to you in the chat room with a word that you don't understand. You go, okay, I'd love to respond to that, but I can't right now because I'm too dumb. But, you know, Jimmy Carter saw this, you know, and it sounds, you know, I don't think I saw this speech when it happened, and there's heaps more of it. But he says he had goals to set to hit by 1985. Reduce the annual growth rate of our energy demand by less than 2%. Reduce gasoline consumption by 10% below its current level. Cut in half the proportion of United States oil which is imported, from a potential level of 16 million barrels to 6 million barrels per day. And it's a complete joke because we can, like, completely import everything now. Insulate 90% of American homes and all new buildings. Use solar energy in more than 2.5 million houses. We'll monitor our progress toward these goals. You never had a chance to do any of this. Boy, imagine if that had been started then. How far we could be now. But instead, he's the most maligned ex-president in modern history, and I always find it to be so sad, because as we've learned in hindsight, there hasn't been a more honorable living ex-president than Jimmy Carter. That's my opinion, and I know I'm not the only one that thinks so, you know, I mean, It's always been kind of my example about, you know, what's a good rule of thumb kind of reference between conservatives and, or, you know, Republicans and Democrats. And I say, well, in the modern era, just look at all of the ex-presidents and what they did after they were president. All the Republicans went to go and make as much money as they bloody could, profiting off the fact that they were president. And Jimmy Carter went and built houses for people. You know, here's a guy who just went like, okay, here's one of those things I would have liked to have done while I was president. And I think I found a way that I can do it after I'm president. So I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. You know, I mean, that's to me the definition of the kind of leadership you need. But no, we gotta destroy it. We got to be stupid. We got to be lowest common denominator Americans and say, no, we want the guy that looks like I can have a beer with, even though he don't drink no more. Sit there and think, you know, how contradictory is the United States as a nation? You know, we're just like all over the shop. And none of it makes any sense. None of it makes any sense. And just before we go to the weekend, I know, you know, you guys in America are going to be like, oh, here we go, Australian stuff again. But we've just had this first budget. And you know when and I really can't wait until you all get to experience this, because it's just so much fun. You know when people who were once in power suddenly aren't in power anymore, and they really are struggling with the fact that they're not in power anymore, and that they just can't make noise and bark and people do things. So, now this budget ain't perfect, but I think that they've had a pretty good whack at it. I think they've been smart generally. We'll see how it plays out. We'll see what the world market does, and then we get to judge. But this opposition, is this not? It's like what once you kick the wind out of them, then it's like all of the illusion of power is gone, right? And you suddenly see them for what they are, and these sad ex-Howard liberals. The two things that they're complaining about in the budget. You love this. The two items that they're holding up and screaming about is the first one is an additional tax on, you know, this pre-mixed, you know, alcoholic drinks. They call them Alco Pops. And whether it's a good idea or not, I don't know. And to me, though, if you're going to tax people who are too lazy to mix a drink themselves, fine, if that's going to help pay for beds in hospitals. You know, I really don't have a problem with it. And the other one is that they increase the tax on luxury cars. So these are the two things that they're screaming about. You know, the big things that they're gonna fight the budget about is is the fact that it's unfair that they're going to raise the tax on luxury cars. I think that just shows them for everything they are. A bunch of rich elites, the top 5% representing, bunch of crybabies. Absolutely pathetic. But I don't think it's working. That's what has been truly just wonderful to see, is that it just hasn't seemed to get any traffic. Fantastic. You know, the usual pundits, you know, do their nya 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 labor, nya 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 taxes, nya nya nya. But it's not getting, you know, the business and the banks have all gone, you know, not bad for a first go there, Mr. Swan. Not too shabby. We can live with that. And no one said that you could had all the control of inflation in your hands anyway. But yeah, not bad, son. And so a guy who I think was pretty shaky on his feet at first, you know, in the limelight, Mr. Swan, is has hit solidly at his first at bat. We'll have to see how it all pans out. But yeah, it's poor opposition. And luxury car tax. Pre-mixed drink tax. And, you know, they might have legitimate gripes about those two issues, but it's just the way, you know, there's one liberal's in question time, and he's got, you know, a bottle of, like, you know, Jim Beam and Coke and a bottle of some wine thing to use as examples. And it's just like, oh, you sound like a bratty little kid who didn't get his way on the playground. You sad, pathetic, you know. It's just, you're nothing. You're nothing. So anyway, don't forget, I mean, you got a whole another day's programming tomorrow, regular weekday programming, fans me. And then Saturday we got Rick Smith, right, at 5:30.